information about nutrition before. I did not especially like the common spelling of holism, H-O-L-I-S-M, for that working together concept. Instead, I prefer holism, W-H-O-L-I-S-M, as opposed to reductionism. It is not clear how or when, historically, the very sensible concept of wholeness lost its W. But in my world of science, holism is anathema, for it conveys a view that gaining knowledge is faith-based or irrational, rather than a matter of collecting and describing a set of observations as facts that have shape and logical form. The best biological illustration of this concept of holism is the indescribably vast universe of coordinated events, activities, and components of the cell, sometimes referred to as the basic unit of biology. We have between 10 and 100 trillion cells in our bodies, each drawing on the same genetic blueprint to do its special thing. The cell's complexity, both in space and time, like a micro-universe, is infinite, and we only see more of that same complexity all the way up the ladder of life and to the far reaches of the universe. Who cares anyway? The principles outlined here began, for Colin, with a narrowly focused question on diet and cancer in rats, then expanded into a universe of questions about human and societal health around the world. In large measure, these principles are his attempt to answer the far-reaching questions that he was forced to ask during his career. The applicability of these principles should not be underestimated. Most importantly, they can help to reduce public confusion regarding food and health. The latest fads, the newest headlines, and the most recent study results are put into a useful context. We need not leap from our seats every time a chemical is called a carcinogen, every time a new diet book hits the shelf, or every time a headline screams about solving disease through genetic research. Simply put, we can relax. We can take a much-needed deep breath and sit back. Moreover, we can do science more intelligently and ask better questions because we have a sound framework relating nutrition to health. In effect, we can interpret new findings with a broader context in mind. With these newly interpreted findings, we can enrich or modify our original framework and invest our money and resources where they matter to increase our society's health. The benefits of understanding these principles are wide-ranging and profound for individuals, societies, our fellow animals, and our planet. Chapter 12. How to Eat. When Tom, my youngest son and collaborator on this book, was 13 years old, our family was in the final stages of a slow shift to becoming vegetarian. One Sunday morning, Tom came home from a sleepover at a close friend's house and told us a memorable story. The night before, Tom was being grilled in a friendly way on his eating habits. The sister of Tom's friend had asked him, rather incredulously, "You don't eat meat?" He had never justified his eating habits. He had just gotten used to eating what was on the dinner table. As a consequence, Tom was not practiced at answering such a question. So he simply answered, "No, I don't," without offering any explanations. The girl probed a bit more. "So what do you eat?" Tom answered with a few shrugs, "I guess just plants." She said, "Oh," and that was the end of that. The reason we enjoy this story is because Tom's response, "plants," was so simple. It was a truthful answer, but couched in an entirely untraditional manner. When someone asks for the glazed ham across the table, she doesn't say, "Pass the flesh of the pig's butt, please." And when someone tells his children to finish their peas and carrots, he doesn't say, "Finish your plants." But since our family changed its eating habits, we've come to enjoy thinking of food as either plants or animals. It fits well into the philosophy of keeping the information on food and health as simple as possible. Food and health are anything but simple in our country. We often marvel at the complexity of various weight loss plans. Although the writers always advertise their plan's ease of use, in reality, it's never easy. Followers of these diets have to count calories, points, servings, or nutrients, or eat specific amounts of certain foods based on specific mathematical ratios. There are tools to be used, supplements to be taken, and worksheets to be completed. It is no wonder that dieting seldom succeeds. Eating should be an enjoyable and worry-free experience, and shouldn't rely on deprivation. Keeping it simple is essential if we are to enjoy our food. One of the most fortunate findings from the mountain of nutritional research we've encountered is that good food and good health is simple. The biology of the relationship of food and health is exceptionally complex, but the message is still simple. The recommendations coming from the published literature are so simple that we can state them in one sentence. Eat a whole foods, plant-based diet, while minimizing the consumption of refined foods, added salt, and added fats, examples of which will be provided in the following table. Eat all you want, while getting lots of variety, of any whole, unrefined, plant-based food. General category, fruits. Specific examples, orange, okra, kiwi, red pepper, apple, cucumber, tomato, avocado, zucchini, blueberries, strawberries, green pepper, raspberries, butternut squash, pumpkin, blackberries, mangoes, eggplant, pear, watermelon, cranberries, acorn squash, papaya, grapefruit, peach. Vegetables. Flowers. Specific examples. Broccoli. Cauliflower. Not many of the huge variety of edible flowers are commonly eaten. Stems and leaves. Specific examples. Spinach. Artichokes, kale, lettuce, all varieties, cabbage, Swiss chard, collard greens, celery, asparagus, mustard greens, Brussels sprouts, turnip greens, beet greens, bok choy, arugula, Belgian endive, basil, cilantro, parsley, rhubarb, seaweed. Roots. Specific examples. Potatoes, all varieties. Beets, carrots, turnips, onions, garlic, ginger, leeks, pinto beans, white beans. Legumes, seed-bearing, nitrogen-fixing plants. Specific examples, green beans, soybeans, peas, peanuts, adzuki beans, black beans, black-eyed peas, cannellini beans, garbanzo beans, kidney beans, lentils, pinto beans, white beans. Mushrooms. Specific examples, white button, baby bella, cremini, portobello, shiitake, oyster. Nuts. Specific examples, walnuts, almonds, macadamia, pecans, cashew, hazelnut, pistachio. Whole grains in breads, pastas, etc. Specific examples. Wheat, rice, corn, millet, sorghum, rye, oats, barley, teff, buckwheat, amaranth, quinoa, kamut, spelt. Minimize. Refined carbohydrates. Specific examples. Pastas, except whole grain varieties, white bread, crackers, sugars, and most cakes and pastries. Added vegetable oils. Specific examples, corn oil, peanut oil, olive oil. Fish. Specific examples, salmon, tuna, cod. Avoid. Meat. Specific examples, steak, hamburger, lard. Poultry. Specific examples, chicken, turkey. Dairy. Specific examples, cheese, milk, yogurt. Eggs. Specific examples, eggs and products with a high egg content, that is, mayonnaise. Supplements. Daily supplements of vitamin B12 and perhaps vitamin D for people who spend most of their time indoors and/or live in the northern climates are encouraged. For vitamin D, you shouldn't exceed RDA recommendations. That's it. That's the diet science has found to be consistent with the greatest health and the lowest incidence of heart disease, cancer, obesity, and many other Western diseases. What does minimize mean? Should you eliminate meat completely? The findings from the China study indicate that the lower the percentage of animal-based foods that are consumed, the greater the health benefits, even when that percentage declines from 10% to 0% of calories. So it's not unreasonable to assume that the optimum percentage of animal-based products is zero, at least for anyone with a predisposition for a degenerative disease. But this has not been absolutely proven. It is true that most of the health benefits described in this book have been realized at low but non-zero levels of animal-based foods. My advice is to try to eliminate all animal-based products from your diet, but not obsess over it. If a tasty vegetable soup has a chicken stock base, or if a hearty loaf of whole wheat bread includes a tiny amount of egg, don't worry about it. These quantities, very likely, are nutritionally unimportant. Even more importantly, the ability to relax about very minor quantities of animal-based foods makes applying this diet much easier, especially when eating out or buying already prepared foods. While we recommend that you not worry about small quantities of animal products in your food, we are not suggesting that you deliberately plan to incorporate small portions of meat into your daily diet. My recommendation is that you try to avoid all animal-based products. There are three excellent reasons to go all the way. First, following this diet requires a radical shift in your thinking about food. It's more work to just do it halfway. If you plan for animal-based products, you'll eat them, and you'll almost certainly eat more than you should. Second, you'll feel deprived. Instead of viewing your new food habit as being able to eat all the plant-based foods you want, you'll be seeing it in terms of having to limit yourself, which is not conducive to staying on the diet long term. And third, you will, within a month or so, perhaps a little more, actually break the physiological addiction that we acquire from eating large amounts of fat and refined carbohydrates. If your friend had been a smoker all of his or her life and looked to you for advice, would you tell them to cut down to only 2 cigarettes a day, or would you tell them to quit smoking altogether? It's in this way that we're telling you that moderation, even with the best intentions, sometimes makes it more difficult to succeed. Can you do this? For most Americans, the idea of giving up virtually all meat products, including beef, chicken, fish, cheese, milk, and eggs, seems impossible. You might as well ask Americans to stop breathing. The whole idea seems strange, fanatical, or fantastic. This is the biggest obstacle to the adoption of a plant-based diet. Most people who hear about it don't seriously consider it, despite the truly impressive health benefits. If you are one of these people, if you are curious about these findings but know in your heart that you will never be able to give up meat, then no amount of talk will ever convince you to change your mind. You have to try it and see it for yourself. Give it 1 month. You've been eating cheeseburgers your whole life. A month without them won't kill you. A month isn't enough time to give you any long-term benefits, but it is long enough for you to discover 4 things. 1. There are some great foods you can eat in a plant-based diet that you otherwise may never have discovered. You may not be eating everything you want. Desire for meat may last longer than a month, but you will be eating lots of great, delicious foods. 2. it's not all that bad. Some people take to this diet quite quickly and love it. Many take months to fully adjust to it, at which point they often discover some new tastes. But almost everyone will find that it's a lot easier than they thought. 3. You'll feel better. Even after only a month, most people will feel better and likely lose some weight, too. Try having your blood work done both before and after. Odds are, you'll see significant improvement in even that period of time if you've been eating the standard American diet. Since we made the one-month recommendation in the first edition of this book, several groups have organized relatively formal opportunities to use the diet for periods of 7 to 10 days only, with blood work done before and after. My eldest son Nelson and his consulting physician have done it 6 times, for groups as large as 130 people. Depending on what diet and numbers people begin with, it is possible to see total cholesterol drop by 100 points or more, LDL cholesterol by 50 to 75 points, and body weight by 5 to 10 pounds in as few as 7 days. Also, blood pressure generally decreases more than with antihypertensive drugs. 4. Most important, you'll discover that it's possible. You may love the diet, or you may not, but at the very least, you'll come away from your 1 week or 1 month trial knowing that it's possible. You can do it if you choose to. All the health benefits discussed in this book are not just for Tibetan monks and fanatical Spartans. You can have them too. It's your choice. The first month can be challenging, more on this shortly, but it gets much easier after that, and for many, it becomes a great pleasure. We know this is hard to believe until you experience it for yourself, but your tastes change when you are on a plant-based diet. You not only lose your taste for meat, you begin to discover new flavors in much of your food, flavors that were dulled when you ate a primarily animal-based, sugar- and fat-laced diet. A friend once described it as like being dragged to an independent film when you wanted to go to the latest Hollywood action flick. You go in muttering, but you discover, to your surprise, that the film is great and much more fulfilling than the shoot-'em-up movie would have been. The transition. If you take us up on our suggestion to try a plant-based diet for 1 month, you'll likely face 5 main challenges. In the first week, you may have some stomach upset as your digestive system adjusts. This is natural. It is nothing to worry about and doesn't usually last long. You'll need to put some time into this. Don't begrudge this time. Heart disease and cancer take time, too. Specifically, you'll need to learn some new recipes, be willing to try new dishes, and discover new restaurants. You'll need to pay attention to your tastes and come up with meals that you really enjoy. This is key. You'll need to adjust psychologically. No matter how full the plate is, many of us were trained to think that without meat, it's not a real meal, especially at dinner. You'll need to overcome this prejudice. You may not be able to go to the same restaurants you used to, and if you can, you certainly won't be able to order the same things. This takes some adjustment. Your friends, family, and colleagues may not be supportive. For whatever reasons, many people will find it threatening that you are eating a plant-based diet. Perhaps it's because, deep down, they know their diet isn't very healthy and find it threatening that someone else is able to give up unhealthy eating habits when they cannot. Vegetarian and vegan versus whole food, plant-based. You'll notice we use the phrase eating a whole food, plant-based diet rather than vegan or vegetarian. We intentionally do not use these words. Most people who choose to become a vegetarian or vegan have done so for ideological reasons. Although this reason is entirely satisfactory, the diet that results may be limited in nutrient composition. About 90% of vegetarians still consume dairy, as well as eggs. Some occasionally eat fish and chicken. A vegan diet doesn't use foods of animal origin, but can still include a lot of processed foods and is often high in fat, sugar, and salt, which compromise human health. We believe that the health value of a diet is best indicated by the relative amounts of fat, protein, and carbohydrate it contains, and that the optimal diet gets approximately 10% of calories from fat, 10% from protein, and 80% from total carbohydrate. Although we also believe that it is permissible for most healthy people to stray somewhat from these benchmarks, as long as their diet still relies on whole, intact fruits, grains, legumes, and vegetables. We don't support sharp boundaries because, for example, we know that calories from protein can be higher than 10%, perhaps even 15% or so, even in a diet consisting solely of whole foods, if a large amount of legumes are consumed, for example. The experimental results on protein and cancer presented in Chapter 3 suggest that 10% is a threshold for cancer recurrence, but keep in mind that this 10% figure refers to animal protein being fed in isolation. It is, however, a level that meets our physiological needs, and that can be easily provided by a diverse plant-based diet. Take a look at the nutrient profiles of vegan and vegetarian diets and how they compare with other dietary practices in Chart 12.1. These data are for England. Most surveys of the Standard American Diet, SAD, show it to be higher in fat, about 35-40% versus 31.5%, and meat consumption, more than twice as high. The average fat content of the first four diets here is close to 30% of total calories, not very different from the Standard American Diet at about 35-40%. In contrast, the WFPB diet strives for about 10% fat. It is quite clear that the nutrient profiles of the V diets are not very different from the SAD diet in the U.S. or the meat-eater diet in England, and all four diets, including the V diets, are substantially different from the WFPB diet. We'd also like to offer you a few pieces of advice for your first month. In the long term, plant-based eating is cheaper than an animal-based diet. But as you learn, you may spend a little extra money trying things. Do it. It's worth it. Eat well. If you eat out, try lots of restaurants to find some great plant-based dishes. Looking for ones marked vegan is a great place to start. Ethnic restaurants often offer the most options for plant-based meals, and the unique tastes are exquisite. Learn what's out there. Eat enough. One of your health goals may be to lose weight. That's fine, and on a WFPB diet, you likely will. But don't hold back. Whatever you do, don't go hungry. Eat a variety. Mixing it up is important both for getting all the necessary nutrients and for maintaining your interest in the diet. The bottom line is that you can eat a plant-based diet with great pleasure and satisfaction, but making the transition is a challenge. There are psychological barriers and practical ones. It takes time and effort. You may not get support from your friends and family, but the benefits are nothing short of miraculous, and you'll be amazed at how easy it becomes once you form new habits. Take the one-month challenge. You'll not only do great things for yourself, you'll be part of the vanguard working toward moving America into a healthier, leaner future. Glenn is an associate of ours who had been a dedicated meat eater before the first edition of the China Study was published. In fact, he had recently tried the Atkins diet, lost some weight, but dropped off the diet when his cholesterol went through the roof. He was 42 and overweight. Colin gave him a draft of his manuscript, and Glenn agreed to take the one-month challenge. Here are a few of his observations. Glenn's tips. The first week is quite challenging. It's hard to figure out what to eat. I'm not much of a cook, so I got some recipe books out and tried creating some vegan dishes. As someone who would swing through McDonald's or heat up a frozen dinner, I found it annoying to have to cook meals each evening. At least half of them were a disaster and had to be thrown out. But over time, I found a few that were fantastic. My sister gave me a recipe for West African peanut stew that was incredible and like nothing I ever tasted. My mom gave me a vegetarian chili recipe that was great. And I stumbled on a great whole wheat spaghetti dish with lots of vegetables and a faux meat sauce made from soy that was amazing. I challenge anyone to know that this was a vegan dish. But all of this does take time. I'm rediscovering fruit. I've always loved fruit, but for some reason I don't really eat much of it. Maybe it's not eating meat, but I'm finding that I'm enjoying fruit more than ever. I now cut up a grapefruit and eat it as a snack. I really like it. I would have never done that before. I actually think my tastes are getting more sensitive. I was avoiding eating out, something I used to do constantly, for fear of not having a vegan option. But I'm getting more adventurous now. I found some new restaurants that have some great vegan side dishes, including a wonderful local Vietnamese place. I know that most Vietnamese food isn't strictly vegan, since they use a fish sauce in many dishes, but for nutritional purposes, it's very close. The other day I got dragged into a pizza place with a large group. There was nothing I could do, and I was starved. I ordered a cheeseless pizza with lots of vegetables. They even made it with a whole wheat crust. I was prepared to choke it down, but actually, it was surprisingly good. I've brought that home a few times since. I'm finding that cravings for meat products are pretty much gone, particularly if I don't let myself get hungry. And honestly, I'm eating like a pig. Being overweight, I've always been self-conscious about what I eat. Now I eat like a madman and feel virtuous to boot. I can honestly say I'm enjoying the food I'm eating now a lot more than before, partly because I'm fussier now in what I eat. I only eat foods I really like. The first month went by quicker than I thought it would. I've lost 8 pounds, and my cholesterol has dropped dramatically. I'm spending a lot less time on this now, particularly since I found so many restaurants I can eat at, plus I cook huge meals and then freeze them. My freezer is stocked with vegan goodies. The experiment is over, but I stopped thinking of it as an experiment weeks ago. I can't imagine why I would go back to my old eating patterns. The China Study Solution, from Thomas M. Campbell, M.D. Having been part of the care provided to thousands of patients over several years in traditional primary care offices and specialized diet and lifestyle programs, I've seen people's short and long-term struggles with making healthy choices. I have come to believe that supporting behavior change ought to be the holy grail of modern medicine, though our current paradigm mostly seems to ignore this facet of patient care. More on that in Part 4. All of us are masters of rationalization. We find all sorts of ways to justify doing things we know we shouldn't be doing, and our social connections and the environment in which we live have a profound effect on our lifestyle choices, more than many would like to believe. With these thoughts in mind, I encourage you to draw bright lines as you try to change your diet. For example, draw a bright line by making a choice for the week or month that you simply won't eat any food other people bring into your workplace. Devise an explanation. Tell people publicly about what you're trying, and commit fully to not crossing the bright line you've drawn. For many people, it's actually harder to embrace moderate changes. It's harder to try to limit yourself to just one bite of a cookie in the break room now and then, than not to have any cookies at all. It's a losing strategy and demands more willpower. Moderation means something different to each person and allows the power of rationalization to creep in and keep you from your goals. I also encourage you to pay attention to your social connections and environment. You can put some effort into these parts of your life in a way that supports your dietary changes. After writing the first edition of this book, I, and my dad in particular, have given many lectures on a WFPB diet. Although the general eating plan is simple, certain questions commonly arise as someone is thinking of trying it. What about soy? What about fish? I thought some oils were healthy. Does it need to be organic? And what about gluten and sugar? After encountering these questions over and over, I wrote the China Study Solution, titled The Campbell Plan in hardcover. If you want a specific eating plan for 2 weeks with recipes and evidence-based answers to the common questions about what exactly you should be eating, with a nod to behavior change strategies, I encourage you to pick up and use that book as a starting point. I have seen many patients become healthier by changing their diet and lifestyle. There are usually stumbles along the way, and it's obviously true that a healthy diet and lifestyle will not prevent and reverse all disease. But I have never seen any other medical intervention with such a broad range of benefits. As I tell patients, for many of our most common chronic diseases, diet and lifestyle choices are more important than anything I can give them or do to them. Part 4. Why haven't you heard this before? Often, when people hear of scientific information that justifies a radical shift in diet to plant foods, they can't believe their ears. If all that you say is true, they wonder, why haven't I heard it before? In fact, why do I usually hear the opposite of what you say? That milk is good for us, that we need meat to get protein, and that cancer and heart disease are all in the genes? These are legitimate questions, and the answers are a crucial part of this story. To get to these answers, however, we believe it is essential to know how information is created and how it reaches the public consciousness. As you will come to see, much is governed by the golden rule. He who has the gold makes the rules. There are powerful, influential, and enormously wealthy industries that stand to lose a vast amount of money if Americans start shifting to a plant-based diet. Their financial health depends on controlling what the public knows about nutrition and health. Like any good business enterprise, these industries do everything in their power to protect their profits and their shareholders. You might be inclined to think that industry pays scientists under the table to cook the data, bribes government officials, or conducts illegal activities. Many people love a sensational story. But the powerful interests that maintain the status quo do not usually conduct illegal business. As far as we know, they do not pay scientists to cook the data. They do not bribe elected officials or make sordid, underhanded deals. The situation is much worse. The entire system, government, science, medicine, industry, media, and academia, promotes profits over health, technology over food, and confusion over clarity. Most, but not all, of the confusion about nutrition is created in legal, fully disclosed ways, and is disseminated by unsuspecting, well-intentioned people, whether they are researchers, politicians, or journalists. The most damaging aspect of the system is not sensational, nor is it likely to create much of a stir upon its discovery. It is a silent enemy that few people see and understand. My experiences within the scientific community illustrate how the entire system generates confusing information, and why you haven't heard the message of this book before. In the following chapters, we have divided the system of problems into the entities of science, industry, government, medicine, and academia. But, as you will come to see, there are instances where it is nearly impossible to distinguish science from industry, government from science and academia, or government from industry. With the exception of the new chapter that considers academia, the chapters that follow remain largely as they appeared in the first edition of this book. But this section only scratches the surface in its attempt to answer the question, why haven't you heard this before? When the China study was first published, it was met with a few hostile, even vitriolic reactions. Why? Because a message that encourages a diet only of plants and describes its effects as holistic is a virtually unparalleled 1-2 punch that challenges the status quo on multiple fronts. Powerful interests whose livelihoods are threatened by the WFPB message were, and continue to be, eager to resist the China study's message, and that resistance is often subtle, not easily seen by the general public. And while there has been increasing interest in this idea from the public, too many people, including believers, concern themselves with trivial questions concerning individual nutrients, individual mechanisms, and/or individual disease endpoints that divert attention from the much more important message, the unique nutritional properties of whole foods. As this section of the book attests, I have long sought explanations for why such an exciting and hopeful message was not yet common knowledge. But after the China study's initial publication, I found myself searching for a more profound explanation for what motivated the intensely negative reactions the book provoked. My second book, Whole, published in 2013, was the result of that search. In it, I examined some of the fundamental assumptions we make about nutrition, biomedical research, medical practice, and the application of biomedical science in the entire socioeconomic political system in which we live. I also explore the complex interconnections between the parts of that system and how they work together, some intentionally, some unwittingly, to create confusion and spread misinformation. This exploration also includes the media, a subject on which the first edition of the China study did not comment, although they often have great influence over the public discussion on diet and health, influence that, due to market constraints, can be very damaging indeed. Hole's writing was driven not only by the negative reactions to the China study, and their increase during the past decade as the WFPB message has gained more and more prominence, but by the discouraging changes I was seeing even in institutions and professional societies whose missions I once believed were the same as mine. I have spent a lifetime assuming, somewhat naively, that those of us who spend public money had a shared mission to serve the public, or so we proudly said. I was wrong. The professional societies to which I belong, or have belonged, have become even more entrenched in their staid, comfortable, worn-out missions. Even members of the academic institution that I served for so long, Cornell University, have made clear their objections to the path I've taken. Certain administrators have done everything they can to sidetrack or discredit this message. I have seen enough misbehavior within the health research and practice communities to last for several lifetimes, enough to etch cynicism into my very soul. Still, we must find ways to tell with hope our story about the impact food could have on our lives, so that we might solve the incredible societal problems described in this book. Poor personal health, destructive health care costs, environmental degradation, political corruption. Make no mistake, these problems are massive. If they are not resolved, they will, no doubt, destroy our society and our planet with it. But they can be solved, and we have sufficient evidence not only that nutrition can do so, but also that it can do so far more effectively than any other means available to us. Many of us know the seriousness of the problem, but few, even now, know its most promising solution. Much has been done already in the last 10 years, despite the naysayers who protect the status quo at any cost, including the sacrifice of truth. But we have a big challenge still ahead of us in elevating the public's consciousness about the connection between food and personal health, the environment, and the rest of society, and an even greater one in connecting this multifaceted problem with its solution. The first step is understanding the players. Chapter 13. Science, the Dark Side. When I was living in a mountain valley outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, my family enjoyed visiting a retired farmer down the road, Mr. Kinsey, who always had a funny story to tell. We used to look forward to evenings listening to his stories on his front porch. One of my favorites was the Great Potato Bug Scam. He told us of his farm days before pesticides, and recounted that when a potato crop became infested with potato bugs, the bugs had to be removed and killed, one by one, by hand. One day, Mr. Kinsey noticed an advertisement in a farm magazine for a great potato bug killer on sale for $5. Although $5 was no small sum of money in those days, Mr. Kinsey figured the bugs were enough of a hassle to warrant the investment. A short while later, when he received the great potato bug killer, he opened the package and found two blocks of wood and a short list of three instructions. Pick up one block of wood. Place the potato bug on the flat face of the wood. Pick up the second block of wood and press firmly onto the potato bug. Scams, tricks, and outright deception for personal gain are as old as history itself, and perhaps no discipline in our society has suffered more from this affliction than the discipline of health. Very few experiences are as personal and as powerful as those of people who have lost their health prematurely. Understandably, they are willing to believe and try just about anything that might help. They are a highly vulnerable group of consumers. In the mid-1970s, along came a prime example of a health scam, at least according to the medical establishment. It concerned an alternative cancer treatment called Laetril, a natural compound made largely from apricot pits. If you had cancer and had been unsuccessfully treated by your regular doctors here in the United States, you may have considered heading to Tijuana, Mexico. Washington Post magazine documented the story of Sylvia Dutton, a 53-year-old woman from Florida who had done just that as a last attempt to thwart a cancer that had already spread from her ovaries to her lymph system. Friends and fellow churchgoers had told her and her husband about the Laetril treatment and its ability to cure advanced cancer. In the magazine article, Sylvia's husband said, "There are at least a dozen people in this area who were told they were going to be dead from cancer, who used Laetril, and now they're out playing tennis." The catch, however, was that Laetril was a highly contentious treatment. Some people in the medical establishment argued that animal studies had repeatedly shown Laetril to have no effect on tumors. Because of this, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had decided to suppress the use of Laetril, which gave rise to the popular clinics south of the border. One famous hospital in Tijuana treated as many as 20,000 American patients a year. One of those patients was Sylvia Dutton, for whom Laetril, unfortunately, did not work. But Laetril was only one of many alternative health products. By the end of the 1970s, Americans were spending $1 billion a year on various supplements and potions that promised magical benefits. These included pangamic acid, which was touted as a previously undiscovered vitamin with virtually unlimited powers, various B concoctions, and other supplement products, including garlic and zinc. At the same time, in the scientific community, more and more health information, specifically nutrition information, was being generated at a furious pace. In 1976, Senator George McGovern had convened a committee that drafted dietary goals recommending decreased consumption of fatty animal foods and increased consumption of fruits and vegetables because of their effects on heart disease. The first draft of this report, linking heart disease and food, caused such an uproar that a major revision was required before it was released for publication. In a personal conversation, McGovern told me that he and five other powerful senators from agricultural states lost their respective elections in 1980, in part because they had dared to question the animal foods industry. At the end of the 1970s, the McGovern Report succeeded in prodding the government to produce its first-ever dietary guidelines, which were rumored to promote a message similar to that of McGovern's committee. At about the same time, there were widely publicized government debates about whether food additives were safe and whether saccharin caused cancer. Playing My Part. In the late 1970s, I found myself in the middle of this rapidly changing environment. By 1975, my program in the Philippines had ended, and I was well into my experimental laboratory work here in the United States, after having accepted a full professorship with tenure at Cornell University. Some of my early work on aflatoxin and liver cancer in the Philippines, Chapter 2, had garnered widespread interest, and my subsequent laboratory work investigating nutritional factors, carcinogens, and cancer, Chapter 3, was attracting national attention. At that time, I had one of only two or three laboratories in the country doing basic research on nutrition and cancer. It was a novel endeavor. From 1978 to 1979, I took a year-long sabbatical from Cornell to go to the epicenter of national nutritional activity, Bethesda, Maryland. The organization that I was working with was the Federation of American Societies for Experimental Biology and Medicine, or FASEB. Six individual research societies made up the federation, representing pathology, biochemistry, pharmacology, nutrition, immunology, and physiology. FASEB sponsored annual joint meetings of all six societies, and upwards of 20,000 scientists attended. I was a member of two of these societies, nutrition and pharmacology, and was particularly active in the American Institution of Nutrition, now named the American Society for Nutritional Sciences. My principal work was to chair, under contract to the Food and Drug Administration, a committee of scientists investigating potential hazards of using nutrient supplements. While there, I also was invited to be on a public affairs committee that served as liaison between FASEB and Congress. The committee's charge was to stay on top of congressional activity and represent our society's interests in dealings with lawmakers. We reviewed policies, budgets, and position statements, met with congressional staffs, and held meetings around big, impressive boardroom tables in distinguished, august meeting rooms. I often got the feeling I was in the citadel of science. As a prerequisite to representing my nutrition society on this public affairs committee, I first had to decide for myself how nutrition is best defined. It's a far more difficult question than you may think. We had scientists who were interested in applied nutrition, which involves people and communities. We had medical doctors interested in isolated food compounds as pharmacological drugs, and research scientists who only worked with isolated cells and well-identified chemicals in the laboratory. We even had people who thought nutrition studies should focus on livestock as well as people. The concept of nutrition was far from clear. Clarification was critical. The average American's view of nutrition was even more varied and confused. Consumers were constantly being duped by fads, yet remained intensely interested in nutrient supplements and dietary advice coming from any source, whether that source was a diet book or a government official. One day in late spring of 1979, while doing my more routine work, I got a call from the director of the Public Affairs Office at the FASEB, Walter Ellis, who coordinated the work of our Congressional Liaison Committee. Ellis informed me that there was yet another new committee being formed within one of the FASEB societies, the American Institute of Nutrition, that might interest me. "It's being called the Public Nutrition Information Committee," he told me, "and one of its responsibilities will be to decide what is sound nutritional advice to give to the public." "Obviously," he added, "there's a big overlap between what this new committee wants to do and what we do on the Public Affairs Committee." I agreed. "If you're interested," I would like to have you join this new committee as a representative of the Public Affairs Office," he said. The proposal sounded good to me because it was early in my career, and it meant getting a chance to hear the scholarly views of some of the big-name nutrition researchers. It also was a committee, according to its organizers, that could evolve into a Supreme Court of Public Nutrition Information. It might serve, for example, to identify nutrition quackery. A big surprise. At the time that this new Public Nutrition Information Committee, PNIC, was being formed, a maelstrom was developing across town at the prestigious National Academy of Sciences, NAS. A public dispute was taking place between the NAS president, Phil Handler, and the internal NAS Food and Nutrition Board, FNB. Handler wanted to bring in a group of distinguished scientists from outside the NAS organization to deliberate on the subject of diet, nutrition, and cancer, and write a report. This did not please the FNB, which wanted control over this project. Handler's NAS was being offered congressional funding to produce a report on a subject that had not been previously considered in this way. Within the scientific community, it was widely known that the FNB was strongly influenced by the meat, dairy, and egg industries. Two of its leaders, Bob Olson and Alf Harper, had strong connections to these industries. Olson was a well-paid consultant to the egg industry, and Harper acknowledged that 10% of his income came from offering his services to food companies, including large dairy corporations. Ultimately, Handler, as president of the NAS, went around his FNB and arranged for a panel of expert scientists from outside of his organization to write the 1982 report, Diet, Nutrition, and Cancer. As it turned out, I was one of 13 scientists chosen to be on the panel to write the report. As could be expected, Alf Harper, Bob Olson, and their FNB colleagues were not happy about losing control of this landmark report. They knew it could greatly influence national opinion about diet and disease. Mostly they feared that the Great American Diet was going to be challenged, perhaps even called a possible cause of cancer. James S. Turner, chairman of a related consumer liaison panel within the NAS, was critical of the FNB and wrote, "We can only conclude that the Food and Nutrition Board is dominated by a group of change-resistant scientists who share a rather isolated view about diet and disease." After being denied control of this promising new report on diet, nutrition, and cancer, the pro-industry FNB needed to do some damage control. An alternate group was quickly established, the new PNIC. Who were its leaders? Bob Olson, Alfred Harper, and Tom Jukes, a longtime industry scientist, each of whom held a university faculty position. I was initially innocent of the group's purpose, but by our first meeting in the spring of 1980, I had discovered that, of the 18 members on that committee, I was the only individual who did not have ties to the commercial world of food and drug companies and their coalitions. This committee was a stacked deck. Its members were entrenched in the status quo. Their professional associations, their friends, the people they fraternized with, were all pro-industry. They enjoyed the meaty American diet themselves and were unwilling to consider the possibility that their views were wrong. In addition, some of them enjoyed handsome benefits, including first-class travel expenses and nice consulting fees, paid by animal foods companies. Although there was nothing illegal about any of these activities, it certainly laid bare a serious conflict of interest that put most of the committee members at odds with the public interest. This is analogous to the situation, as it unfolded, surrounding cigarettes and health. When scientific evidence first emerged to show that cigarettes were dangerous, hordes of health professionals vigorously defended smoking. For example, the Journal of the American Medical Association continued to advertise tobacco products, and many doctors played their part to staunchly defend tobacco use, In many cases, these scientists were motivated by understandable caution. But there were quite a few others, particularly as the evidence against tobacco mounted, whose motivations were clearly personal bias and greed. So there I was, on a committee that was to judge the merit of nutrition information, a committee composed of some of the most powerful pro-industry scientists. I was the only one not hand-picked by the industry cronies, as I was there at the behest of the director of the FASEB Public Affairs Office. At that point in my career, I had not formed any particularly strong views for or against the standard American diet. More than anything, I was interested in promoting honest, open debate, something that would immediately put me at odds with this new organization. The first meeting. From the first moment of the first PNIC meeting in April 1980, I knew I was the chicken who had wandered into a fox's den, although I went in with high hopes and an open, though naive, mind. After all, lots of scientists, myself included, have consulted with companies while working to maintain an objective mind in the best interest of public health. In the second session of our first committee meeting, the chairman, Tom Jukes, passed around a proposed news release, handwritten by himself, regarding the mission of the committee. In addition to announcing our formation, the news release listed examples of the kind of nutrition frauds that our committee intended to expose. As I scanned the list of so-called frauds, I was stunned to see the 1977 McGovern dietary goals on the list. First drafted in 1976, these relatively modest goals suggested that less meat and fat consumption and more fruit and vegetable consumption might prevent heart disease. In this proposed news release, they were described as nothing more than simple quackery, just like the widely condemned Laetril and pangamic acid preparations. In essence, the recommendation to shift our eating habits to more fruits and vegetables and whole grains was being called a fraud. This was the committee's attempt to demonstrate their ability to be the supreme arbiter of reliable scientific information. Having looked forward to my membership on this new committee, I was shocked to see what was emerging. Although I had no particular predilection toward any one type of diet at the time, I knew that the landmark diet, nutrition, and cancer panel that I was on at the NAS would likely recommend something similar to McGovern's goals, this time citing cancer research instead of heart disease research. The scientific results with which I was familiar very clearly seemed to justify the moderate recommendations made by McGovern's Dietary Goals Committee. Sitting next to me at our first meeting was Alf Harper, whom I had held in high esteem since our days at MIT, where he was the General Foods Professor of Nutritional Sciences. Early in the meeting, when this handwritten proposed news release was passed out to the committee members, I leaned over to Harper and pointed to the place where it listed McGovern's dietary goals among other common scams and whispered incredulously, "Do you see this?" Harper could sense my unease, even disbelief, and so quickly spoke up. In a patronizing tone, he said to the group, "There are honorable people in our society who may not necessarily agree with this list. Perhaps we should put it on hold." A reluctant discussion ensued, and they decided to forego the proposed press release. With the conclusion of the news release issue, the meeting came to an end. As far as I was concerned, it was a dubious beginning at best. A couple of weeks later, back in upstate New York, I turned on a morning TV news show, and Tom Brokaw appeared on the screen and started talking about nutrition with Bob Olson, of all people. They were discussing a recent report that Olson and friends had produced at the NAS called Toward Healthful Diets. This report, which was one of the briefest, most superficial reports on health ever produced by the NAS, extolled the virtues of the high-fat, high-meat American diet, and basically confirmed that all was well with how America was eating. From a scientific point of view, the message was a doozy. I remember one exchange where Tom Brokaw asked about fast food, and Olson confidently stated that McDonald's hamburgers were fine.